It's quite odd giving a talk about speech, really. I was thinking, kind of demonstrating its imperfections, even as I'm talking about them. I was thinking, looking at these copious notes here. But what I tend to do is write down everything I want to say and then cross out a few chunks of it like this. I don't know if you can see that. I was just thinking how fantastic it would be if I could do that with what comes out of my mouth. Sadly, no. Chara Siddhi had a good suggestion, actually, that I play the animal song. Please don't let me be misunderstood. It's quite pertinent to this talk, actually. All my talks, in fact, possibly, but particularly this one. It is painful, and yet so easy to be misunderstood. And then again, it can be quite scary to be understood only too well, to feel exposed, which is possibly why public speaking is above death and war on the list of most scary things in this part of the world. So what am I trying to say, title of this talk? More importantly, perhaps, why am I trying to say anything? I've always found the area of speech really challenging. Growing up horribly shy and self-conscious in an English school system where self-expression wasn't exactly encouraged. But I've also been fascinated by it. So what I'm going to try to do, what I'd like to do, is give you some food for thought. It's not going to be deeply academic, this talk, but I'm going to share my own experience in the hope that it'll give you some ideas of ways to go deeper with communication yourselves. Sankaracharya points out in his commentary on the Eightfold Path that Buddhism doesn't make a division into body and spirit or body and soul, but into body, speech and mind. And that was the subject of the talks in the first night of this series. So speech has equal importance with body and mind. Through speech, we express our mental states. Our thoughts and moods become actions. And through perfect speech, we give expression to wisdom and to love and compassion. Through most other kinds of speech, our desire to be wise and compassionate is obscured in varying degrees by varying degrees of greed, hatred, and delusion. I used to blame my inability to communicate effectively on the people I was failing to communicate with. They didn't get it, they didn't understand me because they had different values or they were too self-absorbed or lacking in empathy. And like a lot of other things at the time, I thought that speech should be spontaneous and free, and I didn't think I should need to put too much effort into it. So I divided people into groups. Those who I thought would understand me, and those it wasn't worth putting a lot of effort into. Not surprisingly, this wasn't very satisfying. Trying to avoid the pain of being misunderstood, I stifled myself and lost touch with the authenticity that I was craving. It wasn't that I was lying, but I definitely wasn't saying the whole truth to most people, and that separated me from them and left me feeling quite isolated at times. So after years of feeling that something was askew, I began to wonder if I could actually learn how to communicate better with people, if I could say things in the right way and maybe have a bit more confidence people would understand me. And meditation and studying the Dharma and ethics really helped me because they had a very positive effect on my mental states. And with emotional positivity, speech definitely becomes more open, direct and kind. But I didn't always feel emotionally positive. So there were big chunks of time when my desire to express myself authentically and kindly was quite severely impeded by negative emotions. And I think there's something that happens sometimes. There's a danger that in any practice, really, when things start to go well, we feel better. And we think the bad times are over, or I do, anyway. And I can do it now, I don't need to practice so much, I don't need those particular practices anymore. And then, luckily, something comes up to challenge that. So we're back. So basically, I began to realize that I was still hung up on the idea that things could should happen naturally. And actually, I think they do happen naturally with awareness, but it's a long process. And some things just need a bit more deliberate effort in addition. So I wanted to know how to prevent my communication making things worse when I wasn't feeling so positive. Lisa, can you hear me? Yeah. Lisa's my check that I'm speaking loud enough. So I became interested in non-violent communication and Marshall Rosenberg's system of speaking, and I'm not going to talk much about that tonight, but I don't think it helped me at all, actually, in the way that I hoped it would, in the way that I thought it would. I found it virtually impossible to put into practice outside of a study group where we were all practicing, quite clumsily, but we were doing it all together. But it really did help me to look at speech in a totally different way. I began to see that the power of speech is in the intention more than the words themselves, and I began to try to bring more awareness to that. I began to ask myself why I was saying something, why I wanted to speak at all, what I was trying to communicate, and all things that, amazingly really, I hadn't given much attention to before. I think I'd been trying to cure the symptoms, in fact, and ignoring the actual illness. So when I first started to really look at intention, it was a bit shocking. Far from being just a soul whose intentions are good, as the song goes, I spend quite a shocking amount of time trying to gain points for myself. My intentions aren't always that good, as it turns out. So I spend time measuring myself up against other people. And some ludicrous scale that I can only guess I created unconsciously in childhood, perhaps, some formative childhood events, random conversations, and I suspect some television programs that I watched when I was a kid or something. There's some scale that I've got that I constantly measure myself against that doesn't actually make a lot of sense when I look at it in detail. So I wasn't alone in this. It quite quickly became obvious that we're all, to some degree, competing with our own imaginary demons. There'd be two of us talking, but in between us there were so many projections that we couldn't hardly see each other at all. So we both had our own, perhaps totally different, private ways of measuring ourselves that had very little to do with each other. So look how clever I am, how kind, how ethical, how modest. Basically some way of saying how much better or worse or equal I am. And sometimes, every now and then, we look around and just see these shattered ruins of communication and think, what happened? So no wonder speech is difficult. There's this constant inner dialogue assessing how am I doing and leaving the outer dialogue more or less on automatic a lot of the time. Just filling up space, keeping me actually from being aware. So, sorry, this doesn't continue to get worse and worse. But just a little bit. So it's quite horrifying at first, but luckily it wasn't always like that. Sometimes something happened to change it. Some connection happened. So some real moment that changed everything, or at least changed the course of the conversation. So it's something mysterious, but it encouraged me to think that if I did bother to put some effort in, bring some awareness to my intention in speech, that I could change it. And NBC, Nonviolent Communication, suggests that Most of the time we think of ourselves as separate beings. It's not unlike Buddhism. And therefore, there's not enough to go around. And if we're not conscious of this view, if we don't keep this view conscious, our communication will continue to reinforce it. So we'll keep thinking more and more that we're separate and there isn't enough for all of us. By becoming more conscious, we can begin to connect and begin to empathize instead of competing, and to gradually soften this view, this way of looking at things. We can begin to see people and begin to speak, as Sangharakshita puts it, from mutual awareness and mutual love, knowing what each other needs without constant reference to ourselves. So I realized that unless I was going to be enlightened fairly soon, I would really need some effort, and it wasn't going to come naturally, or not soon enough. But I also realized that, like metta or loving kindness, there's a seed there, so I wouldn't have to create it from nothing. I just need to recognize the seeds and be encouraging. And like the mindfulness of breathing, I would wander off the path again and again and again, and need to keep coming back to my intention again and again. So most of our speech is incredibly fast and automatic, and most of our motivation for speech is unconscious. We're just really not aware of it. So we need quite a lot of mindfulness. And as always, it's important to remember that being mindful means, I'm aware that people have been in my meditation class before saying this, but being mindful means taking a gentle interest in whatever's happening, not judging ourselves to be good or bad. Because when we start to look at speech as a practice, it's really easy to see nothing but trouble and start putting ourselves down, which tends to be our natural habit. This sometimes also happens when we start to practice the metta bhavana. We become aware of where metta isn't. So our speech seems out of our control, but it isn't really, unless we're talking in our sleep. I was trying to think of times when it really is out of our control, but there's always an intention behind it, behind what we're saying. We're just not always conscious of it, and we need to bring that into awareness. And we can't bring it into awareness if we're too busy judging to really be aware of it. So with awareness, we'll gradually find that we have more choice about how we speak. So the rest of what I'm going to say, actually, is about some useful structures that are already in place in Buddhism to help us look at our speech and help us become more conscious, deliberately conscious of the intention we have before we speak. So those times when we're normally on automatic pilot, we can practice just being more aware. So one really good way to see the intention that precedes our speech is to practice silence from time to time. Last time I gave a talk about speech quite a while ago, I ended up talking quite a lot about silence, so I won't do that this time. But I do like it and find it helpful. On retreats, for example, we often have quite long periods of silence, and without that constant inner dialogue that I was talking about, that usually comes in conjunction with the automatic outer dialogue, it's possible to just go a lot deeper with ourselves, and through that to see both ourselves and other people as if we're actually on the same planet, in the same universe, so to connect, really. Often, at the end of retreats, people comment and say things like, everyone looks so beautiful, and things like that. I do, anyway. And that comes from being aware of each other really, because we're not too busy talking and trying to compare. So we can learn to sit with our desire to talk and just ask ourselves why. And in that way, just again, letting the intention become clearer. Someone, I can't remember who, so I apologise if it's anybody here. Somebody was saying recently that learning a foreign language is a bit like this. When you're talking in the language that you're sort of struggling with, you can't be so wrapped up in trying to present something else. You know, you're actually trying to communicate. So that was interesting. Vedanya, who wrote the Introduction to Buddhism, in a talk about the fourth precept, the speech precept, uses the framework of the worldly winds as a way to become more aware of our unconscious motivations and what he calls our habits of editing reality to make ourselves look good. And I don't know if anyone can see these, but these are the four worldly winds. Eight worldly winds. They're in four pairs. Gain and loss, praise and blame, pleasure and pain, and fame and loss of fame, or infamy, sometimes called. And they're called worldly winds because, like the wind, I think, they actually happen, whatever we do. We can't actually control them. But we think that we can control them, so we keep trying to. And a lot of what we do, actually, is trying to get one of these, like, gain things or avoid losing them. So we're trying to get something or avoid losing it. Trying to be praised and not blamed. Trying to have pleasure or comfort and avoid discomfort or pain. And try just, you know, to look good, to have a good reputation. So they're quite a useful checklist. And if our communication seems off somehow, it's probably because, there's a good chance it's because of one of these, because we're trying to get something or trying to avoid something. We're basically trying to control our world, actually, trying to fix our world, trying to fix people, rather than trying to see it as it really is. So, Going back to Sangharakshita and his Eightfold Path. Speech is one of the folds of the Eightfold Path, and you probably all know that. In Sangharakshita, normally you'll hear of those parts of the Eightfold Path as, I can't think of the word right now, right action, right effort, right speech, etc. And Sangharakshita instead prefers to use perfect, so he calls it perfect speech, which I really like, actually, because the more I think about it, right speech really gives the impression there's a correct way to say things and an incorrect way to say things, and it almost invites our judgment, invites our judging egos to kind of take over and just compound our difficulties, really. So it, you know, makes us think of things in terms of I'm right, you're wrong. Pama Dharani last week was talking a bit about how we can use anything, but how we can use ethics as a way to make samsara work, to make ourselves look good, to make people like us, or if it's our particular habit, we can use it to make ourselves look bad, actually, and comfort ourselves that there's no way, there's no point in making an effort. So we can use it for purposes that it's not really meant for. I think the language of right and wrong can encourage this, whereas perfect seems more positive and less narrow. And maybe that's partly because it's opposite, imperfect. Has more of a spirit of working to transform ourselves, working with the seeds that we already have, the intention to be skillful. So it's not just one more point to be gained. Joseph Goldstein, I'm pretty sure, says that he would like right speech to be called speech from the heart. which is the way Marshall Rosenberg in NBC talks about it, in fact, speaking directly from my heart to yours, or you could say speaking from my potential to be enlightened to your potential to be enlightened. There's just a different way of looking at it, which is quite nice. So perfect speech as a way to become more aware. These are four aspects of perfect speech that you'll normally hear. Speech that is true, affectionate or kind, helpful, and promotes harmony. And they're all pretty straightforward. Sangharakshita talks about them in terms of levels, actually, of communication. So beginning with true speech, we're saying what we believe to be true. We're saying things that are factual, honest, and sincere. He puts it, saying what is really in our heart and mind. And he points out that often we don't actually know what that is. So again, we need to become quite intensely aware of ourselves in order to be able to speak the truth, actually. Vedanya, again, makes a couple of interesting points about this, I think. First of all, he says that consciously practicing true speech reveals our resistance to speaking truthfully, and as such is a very useful pointer to our motivation. It points to whether we're motivated by wisdom or compassion or by self-centeredness. He says that, I've got a quote here, true speech means facing and speaking the truth even when this goes against what our ego wants, and so undermining our tendency to give priority to our self-centered desires over reality. So the precept is about speaking the truth when this is uncomfortable for us, not when it is uncomfortable for other people. He says that people often object to this precept on the grounds that speaking the truth can be unkind, as though our untruthfulness was usually about sparing other people's feelings. I know that I have done this. In fact, for most of us, he says, most of our untruthfulness is about our own selfishness, and it is this that we are trying to tackle by practicing the truth, true speech. So he's not suggesting that we should be unkind. He definitely goes on to say later that there are kind ways of doing this. But what he's getting at, I think, is that there are times when we hold back because we don't want to upset someone, when, in fact, we don't really care too much if they're upset, but we care about being the person who does the upsetting. So, because we don't want to be blamed or to feel uncomfortable, that kind of thing. Or actually, we don't want. So it's back to the worldly winds. One last point about speaking the truth. Sangharakshita also stresses that it's important that people are believed when they speak the truth. Affectionate speech, Sangharakshita says, is the truth spoken in or with love, with complete awareness of the person we're speaking to. He says, usually we see other people in terms of our own emotional reactions to them. So if, for instance, people do what we would like them to do, we say they are good, kind, helpful, and so on. We're not really communicating with that person. We're trying or pretending to communicate with our own mental projections. So helpful speech, speaking. Yeah, actually, this is very much Sangharakshita. Speaking in such a way that the person we are speaking to is raised in the scale of being and consciousness, not lowered. So that's the ideal. He goes on to say, at least we can be positive and appreciative, which allows the other person to grow. He is very he talks a lot elsewhere about the importance of encouraging people and having faith in their potential. I think that is part of the speech precept. And finally, harmony. And he points out that this is not saying, yes, I agree with you, but it's a communication based basically on the other three things, based on truth, kindness, and helpfulness. So, almost finished. So, as well as the fourth precept, which I'm just assuming you all know, which is undertake to abstain from false speech, there's a set of 10 precepts which has three other speech precepts in it. So I undertake to abstain from harsh speech, useless speech, and slanderous speech, which are actually kind of the other side of these four things, more or less. So it all fits together quite nicely. One last quote from Sangharakshita. For some reason I found quite funny. He says, one cannot help thinking that speech, which is so precious and so wonderful, so expressive and such a treasure, should be something exceptional. It should at least be something like eating that you do occasionally after thought and preparation. But all too often speech precedes thought, while talking is the rule and silence the exception. So one final word of encouragement. Apparently the Buddha considered, it's quite a well-known story actually, that where he considered not saying anything at all after he became enlightened, because he thought no one would understand him. But in the end he decided to teach anyway, because he knew that even though he would be understood many times, some people would be ready to hear him. So we're not Buddhas yet, but as he instructed in his famous line, we can, with mindfulness, strive on.